Fleming Foundation presents The Doctor Is In. You've got questions?
He's got answers.
Recently, Fleming Foundation reposted an introduction to Aristotle. People often quote his statement that man is a political animal, which makes sense today because we have elephants and the jackass for our national animals. Why would Aristotle care about animal politics? I have heard you say more than once, politics is a waste of time. So why is Aristotle giving such credence to politics?
Well, I think we're talking about apples and oranges here. And in fact, our whole argument will come about of showing the impossibility of comparing these two different fruits. When I advise people not to waste too much of their time and energy on politics, I'm talking about contemporary American political contests, you know, winning elections, working for a party. Elections decide who gets more boodle, who gets to reward his bribe masters. If you didn't even take that cynical a view of American politics, you would still have to say politics is about who has power. And it doesn't usually accomplish anything for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is people try to solve through legislation and through political action problems that are essentially moral, cultural, or spiritual.
So politics is not politics. Aristotle is definitely talking about elections, bribery, lobbying, extortion, cronyism, nepotism, influence, peddling, graft, and embezzlement, you know, like our government. That's what he's talking about.
No, not at all.
Not at all.
No,
okay.
It's not that these things didn't exist in all forms of government and don't exist in all forms of government because man is man.
Yeah.
But we have to make a really important distinction here, and failure to make this distinction will lead to many grave problems, not just in understanding, but in the practice of politics.
Okay.
So before looking at these big picture consequences, I want to start at the small end, as I so often do. I want to start with the words themselves,
okay.
Political animal. The easiest part is the word animal. Aristotle says man is, this is in the beginning of the Politics, man is a zoon politikon.
Zoon.
Zoon. Yeah, we get the word zoological and zoology.
All right, I got it.
And zoo. A zoon was any living creature endowed with movement and a sense of purpose. Mice, for example, they're alive, they reproduce, they smell cheese, and they move purposefully to get the cheese and eat it. So mice as well as men are zoa. So all living things. So in a Linnaean system, you know, you got animals and plants. Well, we're talking about animals.
Okay.
Greek and Latin, when they wanted to use animal in the sense that we often use it, oh, he's a filthy animal.
He is.
You know, or, you know, well, how was your date last night? That guy was just an animal. So, in other words, they had words that meant beast. Now, we have such words, but we don't typically use them. Instead, we say animal. So it's a little bit misleading.
It's a big, huge word to throw as a blanket for a lot of whole things.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So man, Aristotle is saying, to begin with, is an animate being, a being that moves and fulfills its purpose.
Right, like a mice.
Finding food, reproducing, defending itself. So in logic, we call that category, the big category is the genus.
Genus.
Animal. The genus. And animals are, first of all, distinguished from all living things, different from plants, because plants, although they may move in response to sunlight, plant doesn't see food and go after it, not even the Venus flytrap.
I was going to say that.
Yeah. So it's the genus animal as opposed to plant. Now, politikon, political, that's what they call in logic the differentia, the thing that makes it different, the distinguishing characteristic. What distinguishes plants from animals or animals from plants? Well, animals, for one thing, have purposeful action. Now, for many centuries, we said that man is a rational animal. He's homo rationalis. He's the animal rationale.
Homo.
And the differentia here is reason. Reason. Man is distinguished from the beast by reason.
Reason.
Now, Jonathan Swift, in many of his works, and including one very funny, a satiric poem, he ridicules this. He says, first of all, a lot of animals behave more rationally in the sense that they're more sensible in preserving themselves than man. And he says, man is not homo rationalis. He is merely capax rationis.
Oh.
He's capable of reason. He just doesn't usually exercise it. Aristotle, in his ethical works, which include the Politics, he's not interested in his man as a reasoning being, but he calls him a zoon politikon, a living being that lives in a polis.
Polis?
Polis, P-O-L-I-S.
Is it close to Poland? Or
nope, not at all.
City in Poland?
Nope, not at all. Polis, in Greek, the everyday use is a city, usually a city with an acropolis, a hill on it, Acropolis, you see, the high polis.
So it is a city, it's just not necessarily in Poland, or it could be now.
No. So these are civilized cities, Rex. It's a city, but it is also a human community of people living in a city. We sometimes use the misleading term city-state, but that's the neighborhood we are in. So it's the place, it's the people, it's the institutions, it's the culture, all of which make up the polis. And if you were to ask a Greek, well, what's the difference between your way of life and, say, Egyptians or Persians?
Right.
And the Greek would have answered, we live in a polis.
Polis.
And it's true that many Greeks did not. Maybe a majority of them did not live in a highly organized city-state community. But the underlying principles were the same.
Okay.
Now, if we look at the very beginning of the Politics, where Aristotle brings this up in Book 1, he's beginning an argument which he'll take up a lot of space with over the years, but it's that one of the goals of human existence is self-sufficiency.
Yeah.
Because if you don't achieve autarky, to use the English equivalent of autarkeia, which means self-sufficiency, if you don't achieve that, well, you're first of all not going to be able to feed yourself if you're not economically autarkic.
Right.
Now, you can't find it on your own by yourself. For example, a man can't reproduce by himself. He has to have a wife. You can't rear children well systematically by yourself. It takes a family.
Like autonomy.
Yes, autonomy, which means, of course, that means self-rule, self-governing. But here we're talking about that which is self-sufficient. We're looking for that social organism makes us self-sufficient.
Okay.
Now, he says, quote, "Its self-sufficiency is an end and a chief good." In other words, this is the goal toward which we as human beings are evolving or aspiring.
And he was always after happiness, right?
That's right. And
because
you can't be happy without having enough of what you need.
Right.
And that includes other people. Now, from these things, it is clear that the city-state, the polis, is a natural growth, and that man is by nature a political animal.
Mm.
And a man that is by nature, and not merely by accident, by fortune, cityless, that is, somebody who doesn't live in a polis, not because he happens to be wandering around or he's been exiled. The nature of this particular man or his society is to live like solitary beasts. He says, he is either low in the scale of humanity or above it. So you either have to be a saint and rise above, or he compares it, the clanless, lawless, heartless man, reviled by Homer. That is, these are the Cyclopes who live by themselves. They're sort of patriarchal family units, but they live like gorillas.
Okay.
For one by nature, unsocial, is also a lover of war. These people live with violence toward each other because they don't have any rules that govern their conduct.
Oh, boy.
Inasmuch as this solitary man is solitary, he's like an isolated piece at drafts.
Drafts, wait. Do they have drafts? Do they drink drafts? Is there beer involved here? Because I'm getting more curious about this.
We call it draft beer because we draw it from a keg.
Let's draw some.
The name of drafts, it's an older name for checkers. It's various games in which you put down pieces. So what Aristotle is saying, it's in our term, we would imagine, like in a game of checkers, each solitary piece moves by itself. It's not subordinate to anyone or anything. See, chess, there's subordinations. There are different functions. Right, okay. But checkers, every piece moves basically the same way. They don't have friends. They don't have alliances.
Okay. Well, yeah, but it's not to say that someone being alone is a bad deal, because look at St. Benedict. He started as a total loner in a cave, and look what happened there, the whole monastery thing. So it can't be all bad.
Well, no, although it is interesting that he ended up moving away from solitary monasticism into communal monasticism, which is a much more successful experiment. Hmm. But being alone for a weekend or for a couple of days or even just a couple of hours every day is usually a good thing.
Yeah.
But Aristotle's talking about a permanent condition. There are people who live alone even if they live in the middle of New York City, because they're all they're out for is number one.
Right.
Obviously, we cannot in any state depend entirely on ourselves to make ourselves happy and successful and fit. In the Daniel Defoe story, Robinson Crusoe,
yeah,
of course, he lands on a deserted island.
Right, right.
Now, the first thing he does, of course, is rescue all the stuff he can from his ship. The stuff that other people have made, have manufactured, he depends on for his happiness.
Working on that self-sufficiency thing.
But even then, he pined for human companionship, and of course, when he first saw footprints, what he wondered was, what were they? Were they friends, or were they cannibals? Now, Aristotle clarifies, if we have any doubt about what he means by the sentence, by nature a political animal, he says the same thing in different words in his Nicomachean Ethics. He says, man is born for citizenship, for politeia. Now, in other words, life in an ordinary constitutional society where people have laws and
right,
people refrain from harming each other, from robbing, cheating, stealing, doing all the things you're not supposed to.
Okay, law.
It's interesting because there he says is born for, whereas in the ethic, in the politics, he says is by nature. But in Greek, they mean the same thing, because the word to be born is related to the word for nature. Nature is what you are born with. So we're born, that is, it's our human destiny to be fully human, to live in an organized human society with laws and customs and traditions.
So humanity is lost in solitude until a guy named Friday shows up, or you live under the rule of Mswagi III, king of Swaziland in Africa.
Well, presumably...
He's a dictator, you know.
Yes, he's a dictator. Obviously, the people who live under these circumstances, if they are programmed to live as human beings, are nonetheless human. But do they have the human fulfillment that Aristotle says is
right,
what we
okay,
pine for? In an absolute sense, obviously, you can't say somebody's inhuman just because he's in solitary confinement. Or any more than there are people who rarely use reason, but that doesn't mean that we have the right to kill them on the street, although I sometimes wonder about
that. Thank God
that.
For that. I'd be in trouble sometimes.
Now, since human fulfillment for Aristotle in the ethics and politics depends on reaching a level of economic, moral, and social self-sufficiency, this means that human beings have to be brought up in a family. They have to be nurtured to live within a society like Athens, Sparta, or Rome, or even Rockford, Illinois.
Rockford, Illinois.
Now, he acknowledges that there are people like saints who may rise above such needs. Aristotle might argue that even if you're going to be a saint of that type, you should go through a socialization period. Like, you live someday to live without your mother, but it's not good not to have had a mother to take care of you when you were a baby.
Foundational stuff.
Yeah, it's a foundational stage of development. It's far more likely that the man who does not live in some sort of commonwealth of shared values and mutual exchange, such as Aristotle is thinking of a place like Athens, that he would be like one of Homer's Cyclopes. That's the example he gives, who lead these solitary lives with their wives. We might think first, for modern man, for Western, since the Middle Ages, might think of the werewolf.
Oh.
Alienated entirely from human society,
right,
shunned by everyone, who attacks and kills and eats human beings. In other words, a sociopath. Sociopaths don't seem to need their fellow man, and that's the opposite of Aristotle's idea of a man whose life is fulfilled in human community.
Okay, so I'm a political animal because I live amongst people in a city, and any social setting with laws and customs is better because people are better together.
That's right. That's right. It's okay. Not, you're not a political animal because you run for office or you back the Democratic Party or, you know, my party, right or wrong. Exactly. Mm. So Aristotle is not talking about a type of man. Like we could say, well, there are many, Rockford has many different types of people. Some guys go to sports bars. They're sports fans. Nice. Some women like needlework. They're I don't know, knitters. There are people who read books. There are people who go to movies. All of these are different types.
Everybody's doing something.
But Aristotle, that's not what he's talking about when he says we're a political animal. He's saying that man is born to live in a commonwealth, and that commonwealth, that political society, fulfills the nature that we share with our fellow human beings.
Well, it doesn't seem so hard. What's the hard part in all of that?
Okay, that was the easy part because we've tried to elucidate the language.
Easy, he says.
The hard part it comes now, and this is, it's partly hard because I've been thinking about on the fringes of this for many years, and it's lately it's come to me that I ought to really put down on paper where my thought has taken me. A lot of it has been a careful study of ancient Greek commonwealths and also of medieval Italian commonwealths. Mm. Now, in looking at both the way people lived and looking at political theory, I can generalize. Political theorists distinguish between the ancient view of politics, the view of Plato and Aristotle and then Cicero and then later Thomas Aquinas, and the modern view. And by modern view, they mean sort of beginning with the Renaissance. They often have Machiavelli in mind.
Yeah.
Now, what conservative political analysts will say, academic conservatives, not the kind of guys you hear on the radio, conservatives say that Machiavelli degraded politics because he concentrated on power relationships. Hmm. How does a prince gain power? How does a man become a prince? That is the despot who holds power in a society.
Yeah.
How does he hold on to power? Now, there's some truth in that this is the distinction, but it obscures the real difference between Aristotle and Machiavelli and, or in fact, all ancient and almost all modern.
Well, it seems like
thought.
Machiavelli was being playing dirty pool, staying power at all costs, no matter what.
Well, he's analyzing the world the way it appeared to him, and the way, and in fact, the way it was, you know, and the world was quite different.
Hmm.
Now, the big difference we can begin to understand it by understanding the word politics, political, and politician. This is where we started with man is a political animal.
Right.
Doesn't mean a wild beast seeking power over others.
No.
So it also engulfs the question of what the state is, but we're not going to take up very much of that particular question.
Oh, the
here
state, like,
like the French state, the Russian state, German state.
Yeah. Not today.
No. There are basically two views, I'm arguing, about what the word politics means and what it is. I don't mean anything like liberal and conservative or communist and capitalist or Lockean and Rousseauian. Those are like sports fans and novel readers. Those are subsets.
Okay.
I mean the ancient writers like Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics. And Cicero, when they spoke of politics, they were thinking primarily about how life is lived or how it should be lived in a polis. And that life together and the system of life is called a politeia, a commonwealth or a constitution.
Okay.
And the rough Latin equivalent of all of this is res publica, the common thing, the matters, the business that is common to us living together.
Right.
We have, of course, the word republic that comes from that.
All right.
It's not abstract. It's not impersonal. It's not a set of impersonal institutions. The ancient city-state or the ancient commonwealth, it is the sum total of the people living there. It's the ground they're living on, the tombs of their ancestors, their institutions, their customs, their literature, their art, their religion. But especially it involves the people. You can't talk about a polis without the people in it.
Is this a perfect polis?
No.
Or is this just whatever? Because you got bad things in that polis,
too. You got many bad things.
This is just us together.
Yeah. But even in a bad bad polis there is a sense. I mean, Aristotle says at one point, Athens was an unusual place because even after they'd had a civil war, they reconciled. In the better kind of polis, in other words, you treat people more like brothers than, or at least like cousins, than you do like strangers. If we stick to Aristotle, and yes, when he talks about politica, political things, these are the affairs of the commonwealth. It's the set of institutional bonds in which we perfect our humanness, you know, by living together and exchanging together. Of course, a free society is better than a tyranny or dictatorship, but it's not simply because, oh, freedom is good and tyranny is bad, but it's because free people can work in common to fulfill their human needs, and you don't have a government telling you how to rear your children. They got to go to this school. They've got to learn that. Oh, they've got to do this. You've got to get your immunization.
No.
We treat the government like God that exists apart from us. Mm. And it's not just we Americans. This is a very common development.
Yeah.
Whereas for the ancient commonwealth, it's with free people working together, fulfilling their human needs, which are moral and economic and social and cultural. Mm-hmm. Of course, ancient writers divided up known society into classes, like based on who held power, a monarchy, an aristocracy, but also their good monarchies and then their tyrannies. There's good aristocracies and their oligarchies where they rule only for the benefit of the ruling class. But power, even they recognize the reality of power as important in politics, but that's not how they defined what political life was.
So the word politics really has nothing to do with politics, so that makes...
Well, I'm talking about the ancient sense where they're talking
about. Two different things we're talking about.
Yeah. So now we have to talk about modern ideas. How is the ancient view different from the modern view?
Okay.
I'm not going to go into this. I've written mostly in Italian on this subject. Hmm. There's an historical background to the shift in understanding from the ancient to the modern world. It develops in the later Middle Ages in Europe, especially in the cities of Italy, but also you see it in the Low Countries, parts of Germany and France, in the development of what the Italians call a comune. We call it a commune.
Hmm.
A commune is a corporation. It's a guild representing all the guilds or the major guilds, the trade guilds, the bankers, the money changers, the people who control the textile industry. In other words, the various classes of rich people, each one of them had a corporate guild to represent their interests, and then they set up comune, a common guild, to represent their interests together against those of the church, the Holy Roman Empire, and the local aristocracy.
Hmm.
The purpose of the commune was, the bottom line was, to wrest power from the classes that were ruling.
Huh.
In other words, the church, the empire, the aristocracy.
Right.
And to gain power and hold power was the objective of the comune. I'm not saying the comune is a bad institution. I'm not vilifying it. It fulfilled many very important functions. It had many good qualities, but it's different. It made possible the development of great nation states when France and Spain and Britain took on this idea of the government being a super corporation that exists by itself to be controlled by dominant interest groups. Now, one important distinction that's been noted by a lot of schools of political thought, the modern state is permanent, abstract, and impersonal. It exists apart from and beyond both the citizenry and even the ruling. You could change the ruling parties. You could change the ruling factions. The point is to control the state.
Mm.
You know, the state is like a machine. Whoever gets to control the ring of power, you know, to use a Tolkien metaphor, whoever gets the ring of power, he gets to run things. And the ring of power exists for itself, more or less. It doesn't exist for any of us. Thomas Hobbes, one of the most influential and, I might add, evil political thinkers in the English language tradition, said, the state is a mortal god.
Oh.
Though, in fact, we treat the state as undying. For example, the king is dead. Long live the king, because the institution of the monarchy goes on in
his heir. I never understood
that.
So ancient politicians didn't really seek power. They were more doing the right thing for the community and keeping things right, laws and mores and so forth. They didn't seek power?
Well, of course they did, and probably a majority of them were seeking power first or second. Ancient historians and philosophers are often far more, Thucydides, for example, is far more realistic, and Tacitus, far more realistic and cynical about what politicians actually are looking for. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in other words, the libido dominandi, the lust for exercising power over others, which is an almost sexual lust. But while recognizing it, they did not regard it as the fundamental purpose of the polis or the republic. It's not the basis of politics. Right. Whatever the nasty little personal motives of an emperor or a politician were, the fact is that over the long haul of a human society, and in the case of Rome, we're talking about something that went on for over 1,000 years, the political leaders were more like the elders of a traditional family. They're together, they make laws and rules and regulations. They try to run the family project for the benefit of everyone.
That sounds good.
Prince Philip used to say, apparently in private meetings of the royal family, he used to refer to it as the corporation, the family business. In other words, the monarchy.
Right.
And so it's very important not to act like Andrew or Harry or Meghan. It's not, you don't upset the boat, you don't cause scandals, because that just doesn't damage you.
It ain't good for
it
business.
It damages the family corporation.
Yeah.
Now, in other words, we're all in this together.
Right.
There is a sense in which ancient political leaders, even somebody I very strongly have criticized, Pericles, the great Athenian statesman, Pericles, I don't think, even though he was out for himself and out especially for his own family and their coalition of clans, nonetheless, it's very clear that he was always trying to think first of the interest of the Athenian people. And you see this in Roman emperors, even some of the very bad emperors. So the confusion of these two approaches toward politics, the modern one where the very nature of politics is this, the pursuit of power, the libido dominandi, and on the other hand, someone who is looks at politics as how we solve our problems and fulfill ourselves by working in common, whatever the form of
more of a mom and dad kind of family thing.
Exactly. You know, an ancient would not have understood our use of the word, the verb to politic. Like we could say, well, I thought so-and-so was a doctor. Yeah, but you know those doctors who work in hospitals, they're always politicking.
Politicking.
In other words, they're always scheming. They're always making deals. They're always so we think of the political. Mm. Way down deep, we think of the political as nasty little people making deals.
It's a
deals.
Dirty word now, sort of.
It's they're looking out for number one, and it's at our expense. Now, I'm not going to go into this today, but it only occurred to me like 2 days ago. There's a brilliant point at which what this is all coming to when Louis the 14th, when people would say, but sire, he was the sun king in France, the greatest man in the world at the time, when the most powerful, the most looked up to, and they said, but we have l'état, the state, in other words, the French state, looking upon the French state as something which is the possession of the French people, and they're looking at it from a traditional sort of Roman point of view, and he said, l'état c'est moi. The state is me. I am the state. You see, I am the state. I always thought it was a jeu d'esprit. Don't worry about other things. I'm the only guy you have to worry about. No. He's saying something very powerful. I accept the Machiavellian view of what the state is. It's this super corporation that exists apart from any individual. I happen to own the state. I am the state. I am all there is to the state. This was a profound statement and a profound challenge. When you identify the modern state, the state of, say, Tudor England or 21st century United States, that kind of modern state that exists for its own good, you try to use the language and understanding and reasoning that, say, of Aristotle or Cicero or Thomas Aquinas. In other words, oh, no, the state is benevolent. The state only wants what's good for you.
Yeah.
All our best life is summed up in the state. And this is, by the way, the argument of the Spanish Falange and of Italian fascists. The state is the fulfillment of our human needs, and therefore no single human being, no institution, no church, no family, no tradition can get in the way of the success of the state. You see where you lead to? When you put these two ideas together, what you have is one aspect of National Socialism, Bolshevism, and the current American regime, complete despotism and worship of the state. American woman, gonna mess your mind. American woman, she gonna mess your mind. American woman, gonna mess your mind. American woman, gonna mess your mind. This was a presentation.